I want to welcome everybody and even some of our new friends to our grand rounds this morning, which is titled Prostate Artery Embolization, a Minimally Invasive Approach to the Treatment of BPH. Dr. Farah Wolf joined Boca Radiology nearly 2 years ago and specializes in vascular and interventional radiology. She went to Brown University for undergraduate and medical school. She then went on to do her internship in general surgery, residency in diagnostic imaging, and fellowships in interventional radiology and body imaging at Brown Medical School. Her current areas of interest include tumor ablation and prostate artery embolization, which she's going to give us a talk on today. It's my pleasure to welcome
her. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, so welcome. Thank you for coming. Our educational objectives are to understand the epidemiology and pathophysiology of BPH, the origin and current utilization of prostate artery embolization as a minimally invasive treatment option, while identifying patients suitable for PAE, as well as understanding PAE safety and efficacy. So as you all know, and we certainly have urology in the audience, so this is well known to a lot of folks here, BPH is one of the most common health conditions of aging men worldwide, with a histologic prevalence at autopsy of 50% in patients less than 60 and up to 90% in patients less than 85. At age 70, 40% of men will be symptomatic, and by 75 years of age, up to 50% of men. It accounts for 4.5 million office visits in 2009, with a direct cost of about $1.1 billion. This diagram shows that histologic BPH is seen to develop in the majority of men greater than 40, given the yellow component here. However, presentations vary, with some men developing benign prostatic enlargement and other men developing bladder outlet obstruction. However, the majority of men will present with some sort of a lower urinary tract symptom, which is bothersome to them. So histopathologically, BPH results from an increased number of epithelial and stromal cells. The molecular etiology of the process remains uncertain. However, it is thought to be due to cellular proliferation or impaired programmed cell death, and the end result is cellular accumulation. So more growth and less death, so an increased number of cells. It is, in fact, a multifactorial process regulated by androgens, estrogens, stromal epithelial interactions, growth factors, and neurotransmitters. The androgens are, in fact, required for normal cell growth and differentiation, but do actively inhibit cell death. So the prostate continually responds to these androgens, and this is promoting growth. With aging, the development of well-differentiated cells is reduced, and then you have a reduced cell death rate, again, creating that increased cell number overall. Stromal epithelial interactions are also at play, and the prostatic stroma induces epithelial cell development. And lastly, just like everything else, there is an inheritable genetic component to the development of BPH. We know the prostate as the typical walnut-sized gland sitting at the base of the bladder. The zonal anatomy of the prostate really divides it up, with different pathologies occurring in different regions of the gland. We're going to focus on the transitional zone, being this area that we see right here. And the transitional zone is seen surrounding the urethra. It only accounts for 5 to 10% of the normal prostate volume, but does contain the glands that undergo hyperplasia. And with that being said, that is, of course, the tissue that is surrounding the urethra. So, of course, coming into play in terms of obstructing that prostatic urethra. And here in this image, we see the normal anatomy, where you have the bladder, the prostate, the prostatic urethra as a wide open channel allowing the urine to pass through. However, as the prostate gland grows itself and the mere size increases, it becomes more of an obstructed situation where the urine backs up, the bladder enlarges, becomes trabeculated, bladder diverticula form, stones form from stasis, and then lower urinary tract symptoms develop as the urine can no longer pass freely out of the bladder lumen. So lower urinary tract symptoms. This is pretty much how in everyday practice, as well as in the literature, these symptoms are classified and monitored in terms of improvement or progression. There are voiding or obstructive symptoms, as well as storage or irritative symptoms. The voiding symptoms include hesitancy, straining, prolonged voiding or weak flow, terminal dribbling, retention or overflow incontinence. The storage symptoms include frequency or nocturia, as well as urgency or urge incontinence. It's also important to note that untreated BPH will lead to slightly different symptoms, even more bothersome, such as urinary retention, recurrent UTIs, hydronephrosis, and even renal failure. And in fact, we really do see this in our population, given that they are a more elderly population, but these symptoms really do get to the extreme. So it's real and seen in everyday practice. These symptoms are classified by the International Prostate Symptom Score, or IPSS, and this is going to ask the patient a series of questions regarding incomplete emptying, frequency, intermittency, urgency, a weak stream, and straining, as well as nocturia. And based on the score being a 0, not at all the way up to a 5, as almost always, a score is going to be calculated with 8 to 19 as moderate, 20 to 35 as severe. And there's also a final component, the quality of life. And this asks patients if they were to spend the rest of their life with their current urinary condition the way it is now, how they would feel about that. So 0 is delighted and 6 is terrible. And a lot of the men do rank terrible. So, treatment options. Watchful waiting. Self-management is common, restricting evening fluid intake, alcohol, and caffeine. The men who have gotten to me by the time of their consultation have certainly, they're well beyond this point, but they did say that initially it certainly did work for them. Medical therapy is broad and robust and certainly not my area of expertise, but I will sum it up for you briefly. There are alpha-1 adrenergic blockers, which strive to reduce smooth muscle tone in the bladder, neck, and prostate by decreasing the outlet obstruction. They do lead to dizziness and orthostatic hypotension with possible retrograde ejaculation. There are also 5 alpha reductase inhibitors, which inhibit the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, a more potent androgen, and thus cause apoptosis of the prostatic epithelial cells and overall then result in volume reduction. However, they are associated with sexual dysfunction. Additional medical therapies include anti-muscarinic drugs, again trying to reduce bladder smooth muscle contractility. They do lead to dry mouth, constipation, and voiding difficulty. There are also phosphodiesterase inhibitors, again decreasing smooth muscle tone and contraction in the bladder, prostate, and penile tissues. But they are contraindicated in patients using nitrates. So a lot of factors at play and a lot that goes into medically managing these patients as well. So treatment options. So traditional surgical interventions have and will continue to be the gold standard, those being TURP and prostatectomy. As we all know, with any surgical procedure, there is perioperative morbidity, incontinence, and erectile dysfunction. The numbers are changing as the technology changes, so that is important to note that the morbidity has significantly decreased compared to the traditional, more remote literature that a lot of the comparisons are made to. However, with that said, there are numerable minimally invasive surgical therapies. Again, I defer to urology for the latest and greatest in this area, but I will go ahead and mention some that are highlighted in the literature, one being transurethral incision of the prostate, again, for a smaller gland size is what it is touted for being most useful. A number of thermoablative strategies using microwave energy, transurethral evaporation or needle ablation, and newer technologies using water vapor. Some of the minimally invasive surgical therapies also have a more mechanical approach, The newer one being the UroLift, where there's a placement of non-absorbable monofilament sutures into the prostatic urethra through the lateral lobes with traction to increase the diameter of the urethral channel. So you see here where the lobes of the prostate are so large that they've smushed off this prostatic urethra. However, with the monofilament sutures in place, they're almost acting like a band and actually banding the tissue and pulling it away from their urethra. So it's active and being done. I've met men who have had it done, and certainly was just presented at all of the Miami prostate conferences as the newer option. Also, intraprostatic stents are there. But now to talk about more of what I'm interested in is prostate artery embolization. So it's ultimately percutaneous, meaning we're going through a small incision in the skin, image-guided, highly selective, catheter-directed embolization of the bilateral prostatic arteries. In this diagram, you see right groin access into the common femoral artery, a nice cartoon showing the Foley in the bladder as a nice landmark to have during the procedure. The vasculature supplying the prostate gland, a cartoon depiction of small little particles getting deployed into these vessels to clog them up and disturb the blood flow. So a significant reduction in prostatic blood flow is going to lead to cessation of hemorrhage and tissue ischemia. I can tell you it certainly does stop hemorrhage. Everyone that I've treated for bleeding has stopped bleeding within 24 hours. However, the tissue ischemia is a bit of a more lengthy process. It does lead to an inflammatory reaction with cytotoxic edema and a leukocytic infiltration. Once the initial swelling does subside, then the gland size will reduce with a decreased tissue density and cystic change. However, this does take some time. It takes a little bit of time for the body to respond, and I usually say at least 4 to 6 to even 8 weeks before we start to see a significant decrease in size such that you could take a catheter out if you were treating a man in active retention. This ultimately leads to decreased pressure in the prostatic urethra and improved lower urinary tract symptoms when they are in fact due to BPH. The origin of the procedure is quite interesting. It originated in the 1970s, performed as a salvage therapy for vascular injury and hemorrhage status post prostate biopsy, TURP or open prostatectomy, so quite innate to what an interventional radiologist has done for years, just being asked to stop bleeding in a bleeding patient. However, it's really caught on over the past decade or so. In 2000, Demerit et al. Published a case report of a 76-year-old male with medical comorbidities, including heart disease, prosthetic valve, and a large prostate volume of 305 mLs, who presented with urinary retention and hematuria requiring transfusion. The symptoms were refractory to medical and interstitial laser therapy. He underwent bilateral prostate artery embolization with PVA particles. The hematuria stopped, and at 12 months, the lower urinary tract symptoms had significantly improved, and they saw a 40% reduction in prostate volume with no change in sexual function. And this was one of the large landmark case reports that got things going for PAE. Then in 2010 and 2011, Carnevale in Brazil spoke about preliminary and midterm results of prostate artery embolization in two patients with acute retention. One was a 67-year-old male who voided on post-procedure day number 15, status post-bilateral treatment, and he remained catheter-free with a 50% reduction in gland size at 18 months. And at 30 months, he had an IPSS score down to 1 and a quality of life score down to 0. A 68-year-old male status post unilateral PAE, so occasionally it's only possible to treat one side. Whether there's a dangerous collateral to the bladder or the rectum or the penile vasculature or just atherosclerotic plaque that, believe me, can prevent you from getting into the vessel no matter how hard you try. One side is treated sometimes. And this gentleman had his catheter out on post-procedure day number 10, and at 18 months had a 20% reduction in gland size. So you still can get improvement with treating one side. However, certainly not as much bang for your buck as when you can treat bilaterally. Then in 2011 and 2013, Pisco et al. in Portugal demonstrated feasibility in 15 patients. Again, they saw a significant reduction in their IPSS score, as well as a decrease in that quality of life number, and a prostatic volume decrease of nearly 30%, with only one complication of bladder wall ischemia. And the complications in the literature, as you see through the talk, the major ones are rare. What we're really watching for is causing ischemia of the bladder or ischemia of the rectum, and you'll see how the imaging plays a very significant role in trying to prevent that from happening. In 2013, there's a large prospective study of 255 patients with BPH, and again, moderate to severe symptoms, refractory to medical treatment, and technical success in 98% of patients, with clinical success in 72%. And that clinical success, again, being determined by a reduction in category of that IPSS score. So if you're going from moderate to severe down to mild. And then eventually in June of 2017, FDA approval comes for the use of embospheres, which are our embolic particles, for them to be deployed into that prostatic vasculature. So Merit Medical, they make embospheres. The literature traditionally used PVA, which is an older type of particle traditionally used in interventional radiology, but is known to be more heterogeneous and not as reliable in size as embospheres are. So embospheres are certainly most commonly used and more reliable in terms of their size and function, but they were in fact the first embolic agent to receive FDA classification for prostate artery embolization. And this was after much, much work with IDEs and experimental studies. So, and embospheres are used body-wide. They've been safely used for years and years in the brain, in kidneys, in uterine fibroids, so really just a new application for the embospheres. Patient selection. So I certainly see a lot of non-surgical candidates, whether it's refusal of surgery, medical comorbidities, or their prostate gland size. I can tell you that here in our population, the glands get very large. The patients also get quite old. So I've treated a lot of patients in their 80s and 90s, and gland size is certainly even larger than that reported in the literature. The literature will usually go up to about 150, 200 mLs, and we certainly see the majority in that 170, 200, but it certainly goes up to the 300 range as well. And failure of medical therapy is another one. So refractory symptoms despite a drug regimen, because again, most of these patients are on medications and are being managed medically, however, they're still symptomatic. Whether there's limited compliance or refusal due to side effects or a contraindication to the medical therapy. But I can tell you the men that I've seen, they've been taking their medications, they just end up in retention anyway. So lower urinary tract symptoms, again, we do want the patients to be symptomatic at baseline before we get started. So they usually have an IPSS of greater than 12 to 18, and the literature pretty much selects out for these patients. A quality of life score of greater than 3, meaning that they are truly unhappy, because remember, as you got up to that 6, they were quite miserable. A prostate volume of greater than 40, I certainly don't come close to treating anything that size. I spent some time up in North Carolina. I can tell you that there, men were coming from across the country, and those gland sizes were certainly 60 to 80 to 70, but they were also 60 to 70-year-old men as well. Urodynamics. So this is, again, something seen from the urologic perspective, but we would look for a decreased Qmax, again, indicative of obstructive symptoms. And if the patient's in acute urinary retention, that's also fine. Whether they have here a suprapubic tube going right into the bladder or a Foley catheter, it's perfectly fine to treat them while they are in acute retention. However, I do wait several weeks before trying to take the catheter out, because not only do I create inflammation that's going to make their situation worse in the immediate post-procedure period, but it also takes time for the tissue to respond. So again, I really don't try to take the catheter out until the 4 to 6 week period. And we have converted some patients from the Foley to the suprapubic tube just for a matter of comfort and ease, as it's simpler for voiding trials as the suprapubic tube can just be clamped rather than bringing the patient in, removing the Foley, giving them time to void, and then having to unfortunately put the Foley back if they don't. Hematuria, I've seen this commonly in our population here, that the patients are bleeding and they can't tolerate their blood thinners that they need to be on. So that's happened in a lot of instances. I can tell you I have patients who are now fully anticoagulated with Plavix and have not bled, as well as Eliquis and have not bled. So from a cardiac standpoint, they're definitely better off. Contraindications, so really if the lower urinary tract symptoms are not due to BPH, I'm not going to make the situation any better. I just can't treat in the setting of active infection. A lot of these patients do have a chronic low-grade infection, and that is in fact fine. But if it's a real active acute infection, I would hold off in the immediate period. Prior pelvic radiation does make the vessels a bit of a nightmare, just because the normal vasculature is disrupted and the anatomy is not by any means clear enough to figure out. But renal failure is actually interesting. One of the gentlemen at University of Miami, he did one of these procedures with as little as 10 to 15 cc's of contrast and used CO2 for all of the smaller vessels once he was where he wanted to be. So you certainly could do it with a minimal amount of contrast. And you certainly do see men in renal failure with elevated creatinines just from, again, the backup and the volume of urine that they are retaining. And lastly, neurogenic bladder. That's something that, again, I'm not going to improve. So how it usually works is the workup begins in a pre-procedure consultation in our department, a review of their overall medical history, review of their symptoms. I usually do ask them to rank and complete their IPSS score, as well as an erectile function survey also, and then review their coagulation parameters, etc. Whether they come with a prostate volume from urology or I try and determine a volume, I think that what's pretty much settled out now in the literature and what seems to be most common at the larger academic centers is to do a pre-procedure MRI and then go ahead and do your procedure, and then at the three-month mark do a follow-up MRI to assess for size reduction. The pre-procedural CTA is done at some sites, it's not done at others, and it really is a function of how you can optimize those images to see the anatomy best. And we've toyed with it here, and I'll do it sometimes, but not reliably so. Again, the urologic evaluation, that determines their overall eligibility. I would certainly not do this without a urologist on board. You guys are certainly key in making it possible and in the follow-up as well. PSA, of course, there's silent prostate cancer in these 90-some-odd gentlemen that I am treating, but a raging aggressive cancer would be a different situation. And then neurodynamic testing, whether done before or in follow-up, can, of course, be a means to not only select patients but to follow their progression. And medical therapy optimization, in the literature, some sites will take patients off of their prostate medications just prior to the procedure. I've been leaving them on it with the hope of tapering them down at the end of the procedure and once they've had a response. But again, it is a team approach, so we do need urology on board as well as the primary care doctors to think of it for their patient and consider it. It is performed as a same-day outpatient procedure, meaning that I do try and send these patients home. They get some antibiotic prophylaxis, some anti-inflammatory prophylaxis, and the procedure is performed under conscious sedation. They do get some IV pain medication in addition to the fentanyl. They get some Toradol after I've embolized each side. I have been placing a Foley catheter in patients that don't have one, usually once they are sedated on the table, and then take it out before they wake up. It's nice to have as a landmark, and also if the procedure gets lengthy, it's also nice to have for improved visualization in the pelvis. So radial access is considered, it is performed. The literature shows quite extensive results with it. However, it gets to be a little bit less favorable after about an age of 75, just because you do have to consent these patients for a potential risk of stroke. And I know that the larger center in Miami, he's strayed away from it in the more elderly patients, and so my fear is that in our population, I don't know that it's ideal for me. But I have been using a groin access where access into the right common femoral artery with catheters and wires up and over to treat the left side, and then pulling everything back and then treating the right side again all through that single access in the groin. And you can see here they have their catheter up and over treating the left, and then they're going to pull back with their catheter treating the right side. And again, you can imagine that this Foley, as we'll see on some examples, just provides a nice landmark as it's sitting up above the prostatic tissue. So the goal is to selectively catheterize the prostate arteries. And this diagram here being the catheter and these being the arteries supplying the prostate gland, there are parenchymal branches as well as capsular branches. I can tell you that the capsular branches usually are intimately associated with the rectal blood supply, and I usually stray away from those as they're not giving you much bang for your buck in terms of the parenchyma, but rather just treating the capsule, and the branches that really do supply the parenchyma really come off more independently than from the rectal supply. So again, this is what all the to-do is about the procedure, given that there's anatomy to get used to. I can tell you that to make matters simple, we usually come up and over into the left common iliac artery and then get into the internal iliac artery and focus on the anterior division of the internal iliac artery. The prostatic supply is usually intimately associated with the inferior vesicular artery. The superior vesicular artery, being the larger supply to the bladder, is usually quite obvious and more superior, and then usually just below it is going to be shared or individual blood supply of the lower part of the bladder plus the prostate. And you can see here, as you can see on the fluoroscopic imaging, that the median lobes, they do project up into the bladder base, and it can be deceiving that you think you're actually opacifying bladder wall, but in fact it is still prostate. It's just that this tissue has prolapsed up. And then again, you see the diaphragmatic display of the vessels supplying each side of the gland. So again, it's coming off the anterior division. There are lots of variations. So up to 12% will come off the obturator. There's supply shared with the middle rectal, the superior vesical, and the umbilical artery. It's common to have an inferior gluteal or pudendal trunk and then have the vessel supplying the prostate arise either from the internal pudendal or the inferior gluteal. I can tell you we've even seen cases where it arises from the external iliac artery when there's variant anatomy. So that's really the goal of the procedure, and that's where any length really comes in the procedures that you need to safely get into that vessel. So again, once we're there, the goal becomes to deploy the particles and embolize to stasis, as it would be called, meaning that you're going to embolize until you can't see the particles really getting there any longer, and you just don't want to reflex them out of that vasculature into another vascular bed. So you want to do what's safe while you are embolizing. And again, a schematic of the particles going to the gland. Embospheres are what we're using, as I had mentioned previously. They're composed of a trisacral monomer and porcine gelatin. They are highly consistent in terms of their size versus PVA, as was used in some of the early studies. They give you reliability in terms of your vascular occlusion level so that you know you're stopping the blood flow at the same level in the vascular bed. And they also have a smooth hydrophilic surface so that they're not going to clump together and clog up your catheter as you're using them. So a schematic of what you see pre-procedurally, again, as we saw before, where the lobes of the prostate are so large that they've pinched off that prostatic urethra, and then after the procedure, hopefully enough decrease in gland size such that you have an open channel. Post-procedural care, patients do develop a post-procedural syndrome. It lasts for 3 to 5 days. It's self-limited. It does include pelvic burning, dysuria, and increased urinary frequency. It's interesting to me that not everyone experiences this, and I feel like I embolize everyone to the same point, meaning equally aggressively, but some men will call and say that they're absolutely beside themselves with burning and bladder spasms, and other men are completely, nothing, it doesn't faze them at all. But the urinary frequency, again, it does increase initially. So in a patient that has a tent can tend towards retention, there is a risk that I can place them in retention. But we actually haven't seen that. If a patient's able to void after the procedure, they usually maintain that ability right on through. Pharmacologically, I do place them on Cipro for 7 days. I do give them a Medrol dose pack to decrease some of that acute inflammation. And then recommend Motrin, and I have prescribed Peridium for a few folks who are truly, truly bothered by the bladder spasms. So for some patient examples, this is a 90-year-old male who presented with hematuria and prior episodes of retention, again, a high IPSS score and quality of life score. And again, this is exactly as I mentioned earlier, so this is a 455 ml gland. So that's much larger than anything that you're going to see reported in the literature, but it actually makes things easier. It ends up looking more like a uterine artery embolization than a prostate artery embolization, just the mere size of the gland itself. So you can see here, we've got the Foley catheter in the bladder. So you would assume that prostate's going to sit all beneath the Foley, and the Foley is perched up there in the pelvis and not sitting down any lower, because it really can't. It's sitting on the tissue of the prostate. And we have a sheath in the right groin with a catheter through that. And we have an injection here of the internal iliac with the posterior division and anterior division. And you can see that the first branch coming off here is definitely going to go to bladder, but then there's a large squiggly branch which has a characteristic shape that usually supplies the prostate gland. And as you further select into that vessel, you start to get all these corkscrew-appearing vessels, and you actually start to define where you imagined that prostate gland to be, and that actually is that entire left lobe of the prostate. Then with the catheter farther in, deploying the particles, and after the particles have been deployed, you see that you can no longer opacify those distal vessels as they're all clogged up. The embolization technique, it varies in the literature. There's a perfected technique, which means that you embolize proximally first, and then you take your microcatheter as far out into the gland as possible. Some people actually shove it all the way out into nearly the parenchyma of the gland and then distal embolize there and then pull back and embolize on their way out. We haven't really been that aggressive. We try and get as close as we can get. But again, I think it's also a function of the age of our patients, because they tend to have sort of rough bifurcations and some tortuosity in their vessels, given that they are 80 and 90 years old. So that does provide one limitation for us. This is a nice screen-saved snapshot of the tissue after the left side has been treated, and you can see the retained contrast material outlining the left aspect of the gland. And that's just, again, the mere size. And this is still prostate all behind the bladder, as those median lobes are so large. For his right side, we've pulled back, and now coming off the anterior division of the internal iliac artery, you see that there are certainly these first two branches that are going right to where the Foley catheter is, and those certainly look like they're going to supply bladder. However, there is another branch coming off here, again with that characteristic appearance, and that does in fact provide those corkscrew-like type vessels that are opacifying the right side of the gland. So with the patient on the table, we'll do a cone beam CT, where the X-ray detector actually spins around the patient and generates a CAT scan type image for you. And once you've injected contrast before acquiring that image, you can show that you are in fact opacifying the right aspect of the prostate gland here. And this is all from the same case. He just had a really nice anatomy because the gland was so large. So you can see it clearly. Here's the Foley catheter within the urethra, but you've clearly opacified the right side of the gland, and then here the left side of the gland. And on the coronals, you can see that you've pretty much accounted for the entirety of the gland. The left side is a little bit asymmetric, bulging over into the right. But this provides really nice confirmation that you don't have any supply going to the bladder, because as you scroll through, you'll see that you're not opacifying the bladder wall, and also that you're not opacifying rectum, and you're not going to send particles to the rectum and do any damage to the rectal wall. This is a second example. This is an 84-year-old male who is in acute urinary retention. He also had an incidental left common iliac artery aneurysm, but he did have a large gland at 147 mLs. And we're going to look at him because he has some post-procedure follow-up imaging, which is very interesting. So here is the incidental left common iliac artery aneurysm, about 6 by 4.5 centimeters. And then his large prostate gland, again, here you can see that there's some asymmetric enlargement on the left side with some coarse intraparenchymal calcifications. And again, just confirming the large size of the prostate at 147 mLs. So he goes on to get treated, and here again we have access in the right groin up and over. We confirm the presence of the partially thrombosed common iliac artery aneurysm, and then as we come down here we start to see that there are vessels, some of which look like they're going to supply bladder. However, these more inferior branches are certainly going to supply the prostate gland. As you're farther out, you see that this downgoing branch is going to supply prostate. It was questionable, however, on the 3D imaging it confirmed it. And then injection of the more inferior branch clearly opacifies that prostatic parenchyma. I think it could be very confusing to do this without the cone beam CT component. I think that rectal opacification could look very similar. And some sites have strived to do this without the cone beam CT component, and it's really not advised either by Merit Medical or by the physicians currently doing the procedure. You really need the cone beam CT component of it to ensure that you are truly opacifying prostate gland as you see here, and again, prostate gland as you see here, with nothing going posteriorly towards the rectum, and also nothing coming up towards bladder. So with the left side of his prostate treated, there was a flow into the aneurysm sac via the internal iliac artery. So Dr. Coriati helped out on this one. We coil embolized the internal iliac artery here and then laid a covered stent across the neck of the aneurysm, and that was sufficiently treated. The interesting part of this is that he came for a follow-up CT as he presented with acute abdominal distension, and everyone wanted to rule out that there was any pathology associated with the aneurysm. So you can see that there's sufficient exclusion of the aneurysm sac with no residual filling. And when you compare, here we have his pre-procedure CTs, and here he is post-procedure. And you can see that in the left aspect of the gland, there is the central hypodensity and a necrotic appearance. So you can see that the left side of the gland was really, really significantly treated. I did not treat the right. He had anesthesia issues, and we couldn't keep him on the table any longer, and he developed quite significant delirium in the hospital. So my plan with him was to see how he tolerated the left side, and if he got enough improvement, not go after the right. And he did, in fact, get significant improvement. At 5 weeks, he had about a 45 ml decrease in volume. And again, that's only at 5 weeks. We really aren't looking until the 3 month mark. And his Foley catheter was out and he was no longer in retention. The traditional way to follow these patients, though, is going to be MRI, where you will see the central necrosis within the gland. But this is an early on CT, so that's nice. Lastly, this is a 91-year-old male with a history of urinary retention. You can see the left vessel here opacifying the gland. And you can see the right is going to come off just about here. And again, the corkscrew vessels supplying the gland. And he had an initial gland volume of 220 mLs, and at 3 months is down to 120, so about a 50% reduction in his volume. So there are a lot of U.S. studies that are emerging. University of Miami is a large publisher, and then also up in North Carolina, they have published a lot of literature. This is a meta-analysis documenting technical success performed bilaterally in 85% of patients, with unilateral embolization performed in 12%, and an inability to embolize in 3%. Again, sometimes it's really just not possible to get there, but the majority of time it truly is. Post-procedure admission, up to 84% of patients were discharged home within 24 hours of the procedure. And again, I do strive to get these patients home the same day. Complications, so again, pain in the pelvis, hematuria, some hematospermia, urethral burning, rectal bleeding. I haven't seen rectal bleeding or any hematuria other than that, than what the patient has presented with. However, the pain and bladder spasms is what we're seeing most commonly. The more significant complications of non-target embolization have a relatively low incidence. In terms of causing sufficient damage to the bladder or rectum such that it could require surgery to repair, the risk of that is documented at about 0.5%, so less than 1%, because, again, you're watching where you are sending those particles. Blood rust requiring transfusion, bladder incontinence, and erectile dysfunction have not been reported with prostate embo. Again, there's a clinical success rate of 88% of patients with a 12% clinical failure. And from medical therapy failure, it's about 7 to 17%, and with a TURP repeat intervention rate of 8.9 to 9.7%. So it's pretty much on par, but I think that especially here in our population, we're going for a completely different patient than that which you would take to TURP. So it's just a completely different animal altogether. At 6 months post, there's been reported mean decreases in that IPSS score from about 25 down to 10, and at 12 months up to a 60% reduction. The quality of life score has decreased from the fives down to the twos or threes, and the QMAX has also documented an increase. The post-void residual has significantly decreased from about 106 down to 40, and a total prostate volume, again, at 12 months can maybe down as much as 50 mLs. No change in the erectile function score, and this is interesting. We'll touch on this again later, but documented at 12 months as having no significant change. Again, no reported ejaculatory dysfunction at 12 months. Long-term results, again, as we've discussed there. So this is another study performed by Pisco et al. In Portugal. This was the largest cohort of patients reported in the literature, with 630 patients having at least 6 months of follow-up. The prostate volume and PVR improved significantly with a clinical success in terms of IPSS and quality of life scores. Again, follow-up duration out as long as 6.5 years in some patients, where they've got a significant improvement in their IPSS down about 17 points and a quality of life improvement down at least 2, with a significant increase in their QMAX. This again is another meta-analysis. This one has 788 patients from the literature. They showed significant improvement in multiple parameters, again being the QMAX, the IPSS going down to about 9.3 at 24 months. 9.3 at 12 months and 8.9 at 24 months, and that is statistically significant, as well as the quality of life also changing and being statistically significant. This is a randomized controlled trial of PAE versus TURP. This is 114 patients split evenly between the two. The TURP did have significantly better improvement at the 1 and 3 month mark. However, at 6 months, the treatments were equivalent. Again, there's that lag time that we need for the tissue to undergrow necrosis and remodeling. And the long-term follow-up at 12 and 24 months, the procedure does seem to be durable. I've had some 90-year-old gentlemen or 94-year-old gentlemen ask me about the durability of the procedure, and I've tried to convince them that I think it will be just fine. There is evidence in the literature that prostate artery embolization may improve erectile function, and this is interesting. And in a couple of these patients, you will see shared flow between the prostatic blood supply and the penile vasculature. And the only thing I can think of is that when you take the blood supply away from the prostate, it's shunted towards the penile vasculature, and then there's an increase in blood flow. Because it does also seem to be the trend in the literature that is emerging. So in this study, PAE was successfully performed in 50 out of 53 patients. The SHIM score is the same as that IIEF 5 score just where they're rating their erectile function. And you can see that at 3 months, 64% had improvement, 16% had no change, and 20% had a negative change. The change at 3 months, the average increase is statistically significant. And again, there's no new onset retrograde ejaculation. This is an example of the SHIM score or the IIEF5 index. And again, I do have patients fill this out just as something that we can monitor over time. And I've had some men tell me that they're willing to do a commercial or anything that I'd like them to do because this is a whole new life for them. So it is interesting, and it does seem to be a commonality. Again, even in this study, the mean IPSS score has improved compared to baseline down to 7.4 from 25.8 at 3 months, and the quality of life down to 1.3 at 3 months. The prostate volume, again, also reduced significantly. There's one case, one significant complication in this study of urosepsis successfully treated with antibiotics. And again, a statistically significant improvement in erectile function. So take-home points for us. So BPH is a common condition amongst aging men, certainly here in our population. It's very, very relevant. Hematuria and lower urinary tract symptoms may be successfully treated with prostate artery embolization. It is a safe procedure. It's a minimally invasive treatment option. It has an acceptable side effect profile with no resultant erectile dysfunction. And I have enabled a lot of patients to go back on their anticoagulation, which is large for them in this population. And again, no gland size is too large for us, which is very interesting and different for the urology literature. It just actually makes the procedure easier to do. Future applications are interesting. There's talk of putting chemotherapy or radiotherapy into the prostate gland, so augmenting the beads such that you are providing local chemo or local radiotherapy in the treatment of prostate cancer. And those are actively, there is a treat and resect trial that is going on where they are then looking at the pathology intraoperatively as well as post-surgically to determine the effect that it has had. And that's pretty much it. Questions? Yes.
A patient of mine made it down to Miami for treatment of PA here and said, you know, how could this have been missed? And the thought is that it comes off a little rectal. So that's a part of it.
Yeah, we've had a case where there was a vessel right at the apex of the gland, and you could see it dumping right into the main penile artery. And I shied away from it because you can put a coil in to the penile supply to prevent the particles from going distally, and you won't embolize distally enough to cause necrosis of the tissue, but you will significantly decrease the blood flow even with that coil there. So I actually strayed away from a vessel that looked exactly like it was right at the apex and it was going right into the penile supply, and I didn't treat that. But I haven't seen the apex come right with the rectal supply. What I've seen with the rectal supply, again, are those capsular branches that we've strayed away from as well. And I certainly do deploy some coils. I mean, you can certainly coil off for rectal or for penile supply, but in that area, I've seen it going right into that main dorsal penile artery, which is a tough one. Yes?
Is this procedure a complete cessation of blood flow or a partial?
It's
No,
you're not going to necrose the gland enough where it's going to become a dead organ that needs to be surgically removed. There's other blood supply, and there's a lot of redundancy in that pelvic vasculature. So you're really taking away enough blood supply where you're going to necrose the central part of the gland, but again, also not going after those capsular branches that are intimately associated with the rectum. You're going to leave the outer margin intact and leave enough blood supply to the gland. So there's no reported incidents where the gland becomes necrotic, such as if you were to embolize a spleen and it becomes necrotic and it needs to come out. Other than that, if our urologist would think that it would make their surgery less bloody, would be the only thing that.
Because I mean, when the patient historically, like things like cryosurgery or thinking of maybe salvage therapy or CLL or high grade cancer. You hear a lot of people that advanced disease have local symptoms, one of the horrific things that all your office have to do, these Gleason 9s and 10s that obstruct their orifices, obstruct the urethras, maybe like a salvage therapy. Some of those guys, I mean, tell them, of course, it's not going to cure you, but at least avoid them. We've seen guys have the prostate cancer going down to the penis, it's horrific. I mean, just something like that. These are not therapy these people, or is this something
So nobody's going to tell you that, but you certainly use medication with anti-angiogenic factors, decrease blood flow, cancer, and food cancer care. So, and we do use gland embolization with Xgevo or radiation to turn neuroendocrine tumors in the liver and respond to it as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is benefit, but it's not something that we're studying. Nobody's going to tell you that without, you know, without the research.
Yes.
We send you the most challenging people.
I told you, you guys should be sitting up here.
We weren't going to give you the easy one.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.